This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. Barry Mullen was a navigator radar on the legendary Royal Air Force nuclear bomber, the Vulcan. The navigator radar, or NAV radar, had the responsibility for coordinating bombing from the aircraft. The role was performed entirely via instrumentation and was achieved via ground-facing radar and the navigation bombing system, which was a direct successor to the World War II H2S system used in aircraft such as the Lancaster. This allowed accurate bombing from 57,000 feet down to an incredibly low height of 250 feet. Barry served during the 1970s and candidly shares his experiences. He tells us of his time at RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus during the Turkish invasion, as well as details of his mission scenarios, both conventional and nuclear. He also shares information about his escape and evasion training, as well as much more. The battle to preserve Cold War history is ongoing, and your support can provide me with the ammunition to continue to keep this podcast on the air. Via a simple monthly donation, you'll become one of our community and get a sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If a monthly donation is not your cup of tea, you can leave a one-off donation at coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Barry Mullen to our Cold War conversation.
I was selected to train as a navigator when I initially joined the Air Force. I had to go through a selection procedure down at RAF Biggin Hill. The tests down there involved interviews, physical tests, tests of initiative and reflex tests, etc. And at the end of that, I was told that my results indicated that I could be a pilot or a navigator. But in fact, I actually wanted to be a navigator. I didn't want to be a pilot. And I told them at that stage that I'd prefer that option.
When did they decide what sort of aircraft you were going to get posted to?
So the sequence was that after Biggin Hill, I turned up at Cranwell. And at Cranwell, I did my basic officer training. At the end of the basic officer training, I was then posted up to RAF Finningley, where I then started my navigator training. Yeah, the course lasted about a year. And at the end of it, you were told what options were open. You could give your preferences, but at the end of the day, they decided which particular aircraft to send you on.
Okay, and then you get sent to RAF Lindholm for navigator bombing school, I understand.
I was posted to Vulcans at the end of my basic nav training, and that involved having to go to RAF Lindholm, which was the home of the nav bombing school. The nav bombing school had a number of simulators, and also we had classroom exercises. And during the time there, we were put through a number of tests. Learning about the system, learning how to carry out standard operating procedures, simulated attacks. And then as the course progressed, we learned how to deal with different faults and problems that could happen with the equipment and try to achieve the mission with all the problems that they throw at you.
Right. And did some people fail to pass that course?
We didn't have anybody fail on my particular group. There were one or two in other groups that either dropped out or failed.
Right. I think it's worth us just explaining the role of the navigator in the Vulcan, because as I understand it, there's two types of navigator. There's nav radar and nav plotter. And I think you were training to be nav radar.
That's right. It's five-man crew. So we've got a captain, a co-pilot, and then three rear crew, a nav radar, nav plotter, and an aerial electronics officer, an AEO. For navigators, when they left Findlay, they were posted as either a nav plotter or a nav radar. In my particular case, it was as a nav radar.
Okay, and so then you get sent off to RAF Waddington, I believe.
That's right. Once you'd successfully completed the NBS school, you were posted to Waddington, which was the home of the Operational Conversion Unit, where you then expected to train and fly in Falcons over a period of, again, nearly 6 months to a year, depending on how you got on.
And this was using the NBS system, the navigation and bombing system.
That's right. It was a two-phased approach. Initially, you trained on the Hastings aircraft. This gave you a chance to become familiar with operating the equipment in an airborne environment, but at a much slower speed. The Hastings was the training platform for that. And so I had to undergo a number of exercises on the Hastings, learning how to use the radar, basically learning how to do scope interpretation. In other words, learning how to interpret the radar returns on the screen in various different circumstances, such as high level, low level, and in different terrains. Once you've completed the Hastings phase, you then went on to the Vulcan phase, where you learned to do the same sort of thing, but obviously at much faster speed, and in some cases, a little bit more difficult circumstances.
Right. And how do you mean by difficult circumstances? What did they inflict on you to try and simulate situations?
So the sort of thing that would happen is that your radar would be limited where you could use it. So you might not be able to look as far ahead as you normally could. You might not have the automatic system working, and you had to learn to use differing procedures to set the equipment up so that you can still get to the target. And where the automatic system didn't work, then release the weapon manually. As a crew, you all had to work together, because at the same time, the nav plotter would be having problems thrown at him, the AEO would be having problems, and the captain would be checked as well.
Right, and you just explained the layout of the cockpit of the Vulcan, because it sounds like you're all very close together, whereas I understand that the captain and the co-pilot were on a higher level, a little bit of a distance away from you.
Well, we dispute whether they're all higher level or not, but I know physically, yes. yes, the two pilots sat in the ejection seat, which were located a little bit higher up on the seat positions of the rear crew. The rear crew were lower down and facing to the rear. As you face the back of the aircraft, on the left-hand side would be the nav radar, in the middle would be the nav plotter, and on the right-hand side would be the AEO. Normally, we'd be in a dark environment. There were two windows at the back, but they tended to look upwards more than sideways. And they normally have the blinds down. The reason for that being it makes reading the radar scope a lot easier. But it could be unpleasant, especially at low level, very bumpy. Being in a dark environment, you had no visual horizon to look at, so sometimes a little bit uncomfortable, but you got used to it.
Right, and what sort of missions were you training for at that point?
At that point, the mates... type of mission was a high-level attack and a low-level attack. The primary form of attack in my day was the low-level attack, but we still carried out training for high-level attacks as well.
Right. And what sort of load were you expected to drop in those different scenarios?
Obviously, we were ultimately training to drop a nuclear weapon, but we also utilized practice bombs. And we dropped those for real. We also, on occasions, dropped 1,000-pound bombs, and we dropped those for real. So it was conventional and nuclear.
Right, and the nuclear weapon that you would have had on board was the WE-177?
Yes.
Right, and from what I understand, that had 30 times the power of the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima.
Yes, an extremely lethal weapon. Having been to Hiroshima myself and seen the effects of a nuclear weapon, I could imagine that once the bomb had been dropped, the effects would be devastating.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you complete the training, you're posted operationally. Where do you end up?
At the end of the Vulcan Operational Conversion Unit training, I was approached to see if I would fill a shortage they had out in Akrotiri in Cyprus and join up with another crew at short notice. As I was single at the time, I had no commitments. Cyprus sounded quite interesting. And I accepted the posting and was sent out to Akrotiri, where I joined my new crew.
Right. And what were you continuing your training of the various different scenarios at that point?
Yes. Before you become operational, you have to undergo a number of conversion exercises where the crew is checked out to see how proficient they are. So you fly a number of missions with a checker on board, and he assesses whether the crew has the capability to carry out full operational flying. Once you've passed that, you then go onto the squadron as a fully operational crew with the rest of the guys.
Right. And so Akrotiri, I guess I'm trying to understand what sort of missions were flying from there, but I guess the intention was to be able to fly long distance towards targets in the Warsaw Pact countries. Even from somewhere like Cyprus or not?
It's interesting. It's a part of the Cold War that a lot of people don't talk about, because the UK was actually part of an organisation known as CENTO, which originated from a treaty signed, I understand, sometime in the 50s with Iraq, Iran, Pakistan and the UK, and then later on Iraq left and the Americans joined, and it became CENTO. And the function of CENTO was really to contain the communist threat on the southern part of Russia, going towards India and Pakistan. So our missions were tied in with CENTO, and we trained to fly high-low to carry out missions in that area.
Presumably flying in that part of the world was quite different in terms of atmospherics and things like that. I guess you're not going to see much because you're just looking at your scope.
No, occasionally I used to go up on the ladder and have a look to see what things looked like when we had a quiet period. So I did get the opportunity outside sometime. As an example, one of the trips we used to do from Akrotiri is we'd go away for 3 or 4 nights to Tehran in Iran and fly some missions from Tehran out to the desert, out towards the mountains, practicing low-level attacks. The only constraint we had was that the Iranians were always very cautious, and we had to have an Iranian observer on board the aircraft. In our case, when we went, I can remember we had an S-4 pilot who had to sit behind us in what they call the sixth seat and just monitor that we weren't going where we weren't supposed to go.
Right, and this was 1974, so before the Islamic Revolution.
That's correct, yeah. Well, I don't think he really enjoyed his trip because he was very ill. At low level, the temperature was up to nearly 50 outside. We were very low over the desert. It was extremely bumpy. And I don't think he had a very pleasant trip. So I think that was probably his one and only trip in the Vulcan.
Yeah. Now, while you're in Cyprus in 1974, there's an invasion.
That's right. The Turks invaded the north of the island. It was all very confusing to begin with. Nobody quite knew what was going on. But intelligence gradually came through. And it became clear that the Turks also had some aircraft as well as boats and ships in the north of the island. And so the decision was made to ground the aircraft to ascertain what was going on, worry being that there could be a missile such as the SAM 7 set up at the end of the runway, which we might not be aware of, which could shoot down aircraft if they got airborne. So before we were allowed to get airborne, they had to clear that it was safe to do that.
Right. And this was quite a strange situation because it was effectively two NATO countries going to war with each other.
In effect, yes. But there's a long history between the Greeks and the Turks. And there's been an argument over Cyprus for a number of years. So I think this has been boiling up for quite a while. And when the coup actually happened, that was the trigger to set off the invasion by the Turks.
Yeah, and you were the duty officer the night the invasion started.
I was indeed. Duty officer was really just to deal with any issues that happened while the station commander was away at home. And you were supposed to manage the day-to-day, or in my case, the nighttime issues that came up. This particular evening, I started to get some signals coming through, which in itself is not unusual. They're usually restricted or confidential signals, but in this case, they were flash signals, which was extremely disconcerting, as flash signals are normally reserved for extreme emergencies, such as wartime. And pretty quickly, I had three flash signals on my desk, and we were desperately trying to get hold of the station commander and other key personnel to get them in as quickly as possible to sort out the procedures. And sure enough, that happened, and I gradually faded to the background and went back to my squadron to join in with the rest of the guys to see how things progressed. When the decision was finally made that we could get airborne again, they decided that they would check it out by sending an aircraft up to do some circuits. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, our crew was selected to do that, which was a bit disconcerting as we didn't quite know what was going to happen. We weren't sure whether there was going to be a risk from a SAM 7 or something like that being shot at us. So we decided we'd just do some basic pilot circuits and see how things went. And for that trip, I sat the whole time with my seat swiveled, ready to pull the handle to go down in the bay and open the door and jump out as quickly as possible. It was a bit of a worrying time, but fortunately, nothing happened. The aircraft landed, and thereafter, the rest of the aircraft were able to utilize the airfield for normal missions.
Right. And did the Vulcan have any defense against a surface-to-air missile beyond trying to outmaneuver it?
Outmaneuver it. And they did have some ECM, but I would suspect that it wouldn't have been a lot of use.
Right, right. We'll talk about the method of exiting a Vulcan in flight in a little while. So once the invasion had happened, there were lots of holidaymakers still on the island, I understand.
That's right. It had been decided that the holidaymakers would be pulled out and sent home, and this involved their own countries providing aircraft to come and pick them up to take them back. Unfortunately, this took a little bit of organizing, and for safety reasons, the different tourists were pulled back from their holiday homes and hotels back onto the Akrotiri base, because that was the safest place to be. They were put up in hangars and other large buildings, and it was fairly traumatic. There were a lot of families with kids running around getting very upset. Obviously, a lot of people were very worried as to what was going to happen, and our job was basically to act as an intermediary, get whatever they needed to help them, talk them through it, and provide them with as much assistance as we could. Could be a little bit stressful at times, although for a young guy, if you got this Swedish tourist, there were a few perks as well.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more. Did you remain on Cyprus, or was the squadron dispersed elsewhere?
Well, initially, once it was clear that it was okay to fly, we were then tasked with carrying out a maritime reconnaissance role to gather intelligence as to what the Turks were actually doing. And so the squadron would send aircraft up, and we would then have to monitor using the radar to see what was actually happening on the ground during the Turkish attacks. And we'd fly at high level in almost a circular pattern and monitor the movement of boats as they came out from the north of the island. You could see all this on the radar. Watch them go around to some of the holiday centres like Famagusta, etc., where they carry out attacks. And the pilots could actually see the sky lighting up as this happened. And then the timings, the number of boats, etc., all the information that we could gather was passed over to the air electronics officer, and he relayed the information directly back to the UK, where they were using it, obviously, for their intelligence purposes.
Right. So when did you return back to England?
Well, initially, the aircraft, there was a bit of confusion, and the aircraft were dispersed. And some aircraft were sent back to the UK, some were sent to Malta, and this was just to get them off base while they were deciding what they were going to do with us. I went to Malta with my crew and a number of other aircraft, and we spent a couple of weeks there waiting to see what was going to happen. Eventually, we were called back, and we were told that all the squadrons, all the Vulcan squadrons, were going to be pulled back to the UK, and they would be leaving Ekaterinburg.
Okay, and then you're sent back to RAF Waddington, aren't you?
That's right, yes. 9 Squadron was relocated at RAF Waddington, and I finished the rest of my tour on 9 Squadron at RAF Waddington.
Right, but you're also doing training abroad as well, aren't you?
Yes, different scenarios this time. The overseas flights were primarily to Canada, somewhere called Goose Bay, and occasionally over to Nebraska in the States, at Omaha. We'd fly a lot of low-level flights out there. In particular, in Canada, we'd fly extremely low and on occasions below 300 feet. And that was very similar terrain to probably what you'd get in some parts of Russia. So it was used for training from that aspect. The only problem with the area is it's extremely cold. And it's not the sort of place I would have liked to have had a problem and had to bail out. The temperatures got very, very cold, and it was obviously very snowy as well. But interesting flying. We also did low-level flying in the States, and that was mixed up a little bit with some air-to-air combat with American aircraft who would request a few moments with our aircraft to see if they could intercept us, and then we'd do a little bit of air-to-air work with them, see how we got on, how they were interested to see how they got on with a large aircraft as well.
I mean, you mentioned bailing out, and from what I understand, the bailing out procedure from a Vulcan, particularly for the two navigators and the AEO, was not that easy.
No. The pilots had ejection seats, but the rear crew didn't. So the sequence was that the nav radar would have to swivel his seat, pull the handle, which would push him forward into the well. He would then have to open the door, the ladder would slide out, and he would then follow that. The next guy down would be the AEO, and then the plotter. The caveat with this was that the aircraft really needed to be straight and level, for you to have a good chance of getting out the aircraft, and obviously at a reasonable height as well. The problem is that if the aircraft had any G-force or was at an angle, it was very difficult. And certainly we did lose people. We had Night Squadron, we had an aircraft that crashed out in Malta. All the rear crew were killed in that one because the aircraft caught fire. It was no longer straight level. The guys couldn't get out and they were killed. It was talked about amongst the crew as to how we deal with any issue that came up. And to be fair to the pilots, they were always adamant they would stay with the aircraft until they could get the crew out. And they would stay with them until it was not possible to stay any longer.
Because I think you mentioned to me before there was an extra challenge if the undercarriage was down as well.
Yes, the problem is that with the undercarriage down, the front nose wheel was directly in front of you as you opened the door. And if you jumped out, you'd just go smack into that. We did talk about that. We did train a little bit on the ground, practicing jumping out. And the technique was evolved whereby you could grab one of the ramps on the side and try and swing yourself around to one side to try and avoid being hit by the nose wheel. Not something I would have liked to have tried, although I believe that somebody actually did it successfully. I'm not 100% sure of that.
Right. Wow. Wow. So you were wearing your parachute all the time in the cabin?
Yes, effectively, the parachute is on the seat. So when you come in, you strap in and you put all the clips in the front bracket, and the parachute is then literally on your back. So as you lift, stand up, you pull the parachute with you as well.
Right. Okay, got it. And What training were you given in escape and evasion?
It was the basic squadron training, where the squadron go out and we do a small exercise on how to evade and how to utilise the maps, etc. you were given, and a little bit on how to cook meals in a surviving situation. But if you wanted a little bit more training, the squadron would send you off to something like the Winter Survivor School in Germany. I went on that one, and that was a little bit more intense because we were actually put in situations which were quite arduous and are quite stressful. And having to sleep overnight with just a parachute above you in freezing cold temperatures is a lot of fun. They gave you a rabbit to eat. You had to learn to cook that yourself and manage. And then there would be an escape and evasion exercise at the end where you had to get to a rendezvous point with the German troops chasing you through the woods. The idea was to evade them as best you could and get to the RV. If you were unsuccessful and you got caught, you were then interrogated by the interrogation specialist. And you've had to learn how to deal with different sorts of interrogation, such as very loud, noisy shouting and somebody being very nice. I actually got interrogated on one exercise by a lady, which was quite difficult, actually, I have to say. And I ended up in a stress position for a long period during the night, and was shivering quite badly at the end of it. But it gave you an idea of what you could get and how difficult it was to resist it.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that incentivized you to evade better on the next course.
It did, because in that particular case, at the German one, we actually decided that we'd go the long way around the route, whereas I know some of the American Special Forces guys decided they could evade by going through the middle of the route. They got caught. We didn't, but I have to be honest, when we came to a bridge over a river, which was the only way over it, there were some troops there. We knew we'd get caught, so we were actually went out the area, and we found a crossing point further up river, got across there and avoided them. I can now publicly release that, as I'm sure no one's going to stop me on the road. Christopher.
Right. I bet they wondered how you managed to avoid them. But anyway, the secret's out now, Barry.
It is.
Okay, that's some really interesting detail you've shared there. Now, you must have been a good navigator because you get posted as an instructor, don't you?
Yes, on completion of my tour on Night Squadron, I was posted to 230 OCU at Scampton as an instructor.
Obviously, you're teaching other navigators, but what does that role entail? Is it still on the Vulcan or is it across other aircraft types?
Mainly the Vulcan. The classroom exercises where we actually taught the students about the equipment and how to use it, etc., were mainly Vulcan ones. The simulator exercises we took were mainly Vulcan ones, but we also did flying exercises with the students. With the Hastings flying, which was on what was called 1066 Squadron, there was a number of us used to take our navigators from Finningley. We'd be not only posted onto the Vulcan, but also posted onto F4 Phantoms and Buccaneers. The reason being that it would give those SpaceJet navigators some experience in using a radar at low level. And so we had special exercises set up for them, as well as doing the normal Vulcan navigator training.
Right, right. And I think you were also selected for a Vulcan display crew as well for a while.
Yeah, the crew changed every year, and I was selected along with some other guys on the squadron to set up a display crew to fly the Vulcan in the display at various bases in the UK throughout the year. We ended up at the end of it being given a trip out to America. And in our case, we went to Bergstrom Air Base in Texas to fly a display out there.
Right. And was the Vulcan a popular aircraft amongst the Americans?
Certainly with the Americans, it was very popular. Well, I think probably because they had absolutely nothing like it. And we were always looked after very well by the Americans. They very, very interested in the aircraft. And generally, it was always enjoyable doing it, going over there.
Right, right. And I think there was one time where you went to Lyndon Johnson's ranch and met his wife, Lady Bird Johnson.
That's right. On the day of the display, we flew over the state capitol with some American fighters in formation. After landing, we did the display, and then we went in the officers' mess afterwards for some drinks with the Americans. While we were there, we were told that a request had come down from Lady Bird Johnson, and she asked for the crew to go out to her ranch the following day.
Right, so what was that like?
Very interesting. Quite clearly, the wife of a Mexican American president is not something you expect to happen when you go away on these trips. But the ranch, we went out to LBJ's ranch. She was very, very pleasant, very chatty, showed us around. He had a fantastic collection of classic cars, which was very interesting. Gained us some drinks, and all in all, very, very pleasant trip. We posed for photos, and that was it.
Right, right, okay. So after that, you're then posted back operationally to 50 Squadron.
That's right. On completion of the 230 OCU tour, I went back to Operational Squadron, joined up with a new crew, and flew with them.
Right. These were different mission profiles, though, that you were working on.
It's still the standard operational mission profiles that I'd flown on Night Squadron. The only difference was, clearly, it was with a different crew.
You'd mentioned in the notes that you sent to me the nuclear weapons simulator checks. Can you describe what that involved?
Okay. Well, part of the other squadron is that you have basic training requirements. So you have to carry out a number of tasks in a certain period. So by that, I mean you have to carry out a number of certain sorts of attacks. The plotter had to do certain sorts of navigation trips. For instance, we had astro navigation. We have to do at least one or two trips of that. We also had to have a number of simulator exercises where we go in the simulator and be assessed. And we'd also have nuclear weapon training. That training would involve using a small simulator where the nav radar and nav plotter would sit down and go through the switching actions to release a nuclear weapon. And then the instructor would throw a number of faults at them to see how they coped. And he would be assessing how effective we were at dealing with those issues and if whether or not we actually got the weapon away. In my particular case, a little story, we had a particularly nasty instructor who would give you some pretty awful faults. And myself and my plotter were being put through the mill somewhat, and he was failing a lot of our equipment, and he was trying to catch us out. And we got to the stage where everything had just about gone, but I could just about get the weapon off, and he was hassling me, saying, "Well, what are you going to do? Where are you going to release the weapon? You're going to release it, yes, but where are you going to release it?" And I'd had enough at this stage, and I turned around to him and I said, "Al, where do you live?"
Did he take that well?
Loved. Yes.
Right, right. You also talk about the crews and the target study, because what I hadn't realized was that you knew what your target was going to be if the balloon went up.
Yes, over and above the training targets, which is all simulated target, we also did target study, which involved looking at the target we were actually expected to attack in the event that we were given full nuclear release.
Can you tell me what that target was?
Well, had a number of targets. The one I do remember is Tallinn, not the city itself, but actually a military complex outside the city. That was the principal target that we were aiming at. But quite clearly, with a nuclear weapon, it would have been quite devastating for the local area as well.
And what intelligence information were you provided with in order to study the target?
We were put in a room, we locked the door, and then we'd open the safe and pull out the intelligence information that had been provided. That intelligence information included an initial plan of the route, the types of surface-to-air missiles you could expect to come across, the type of aircraft you could expect to come across, their location, and you then had to sit down and amongst yourselves decide on how you were going to carry out this attack. So it may be that you alter the route to avoid a certain SAM complex, or you may alter it to keep out range of certain aircraft as best you could. So we were left with sorting it out amongst ourselves and deciding how we're going to carry out the attack and what the issues would be. One of the issues was quite clearly what would happen once we'd released the weapon, because the brief is that clearly you fly back to your base. But it may have been the case that the base wasn't there. So we had to consider different options as to where we go and what we do.
Right, right. And what did those discussions consist of? What were the options that you talked about?
Well, we were limited to a large extent by the amount of fuel we had and what height we were going to fly back. And it was really trying to find somewhere which we thought might be relatively safe. And without being too specific, we decided that going south would be the best option. The difficulty is, of course, that you still had other threats to avoid. So whether we made it or not, I guess we'll never know. But it was very difficult, but we had to come up with some sort of plan.
Right, right. And your role is pretty crucial in this, because you are controlling the release of the nuclear weapon, aren't you?
Yes. During an attack, what happens is that once we get into the attack phase, the aircraft accelerates and the nav radar is then really responsible for getting the aircraft to the target. So this would involve him using the radar to identify significant features which he could aim at to get the aircraft as accurately as possible to the target and get the weapon released as accurately as possible. These were known as offsets, which are basically significant radar features set a certain distance away from the target. We'd have offset one, which should be the aiming offset, and offset two, which we'd call the leading offset. The leading offset would something that you could pick up fairly early in the run, and then that would give the aircraft an initial heading to fly on. At this stage, with autopilot in, the nav radar is really controlling the aircraft in a horizontal sense. So it'd be going left or right, depending on how you move the radar stick. In a war situation, it'd be difficult because you'd be switching your radar on and off. You don't want to give your position away too easily, and the radar would only stay on during the final phases of the attack. So as you come in, you get the first offset. You then come into the aiming offset. You have got the system set up in automatic. We call this the switch, actually. It goes across and it's called bomb. That puts the aircraft under the nav radar's control, and it would then count down the range to the release. The pilots would be concentrating on keeping the aircraft flying directly towards the target by following their instruments. And as you got close to the target, the radar would then open up the bomb doors. Bomb doors open. As you come over the target, bomb gone, bomb doors shut. Accelerate and get away as quickly as possible.
Right, right. And how did you feel about that responsibility and the fact that you were releasing such a powerful weapon?
Well, I've had plenty of time to reflect on it. Quite clearly, it's a horrific weapon. But at that time, it was something that you tried not to think about too much. We're all young lads anyway. And we tried to stay as professional as possible and think of it more in a mechanical mode, whereby you are doing a job and you're doing it in response to a first attack. So it's not like me and going as the aggressor. We were going as the responder. And it was worth considering that maybe they had dropped a weapon which had kill family, friends, relatives. Not that you were thinking about it in terms of revenge, but once you're on the aircraft and going that way, I think we'd have all just concentrated on doing our job to the best of our ability.
Yeah, yeah, no, understood. I mean, that was the intention of the training, was that you would work together to do what the job entailed.
Yeah.
And not necessarily question things like that. But you must have thought about what would have happened to your family and your friends as well.
Yes. I mean, it's quite horrific, which is why I'm so pleased, obviously, that nothing ever happened. So I know it's one of the arguments used for deterrence is that it stops the other person attacking you. So maybe it was successful in that. Knowing that we had an effective response was something which made an aggressor think twice about.
Yeah, yeah. And did the RAF prepare you for that level of responsibility? I mean, did they do psychological analysis or anything like that? Or, I guess not in the 1970s.
Not in those days, Ian. No, yeah. Not in those days. You really, I have heard of people saying, well, I can't do this job. But that was well before they got onto something like the Vulcan. It was very early days. We lost somebody because of that. But it's a personal choice. And at the end of the day, as you say, it's a job and you have to stay as professional and as detached as you can. Do it professionally. There are other people out there in positions to argue whether we should or shouldn't do it. That wasn't our job.
Yeah, yeah. And your training also included things like a scramble.
Yes.
I mean, you weren't on QRA, were you?
No, QRA at Finnish by the time I was in the Balkans, but we used to have a lot of exercises, in particular something called TACEVAL, which is a tactical evaluational station. And a team of people, independent people, would turn up and start issuing orders and giving scenarios out as to what is going to happen. The station was tested. Everybody from the station commander downwards were all tested in various things. And as far as the crews are concerned, this meant that we were questioned on our targets. We were quizzed about our knowledge of the systems. And then as the exercise progressed, we knew at some stage we'd be scrambled. So we'd be put on standby. And eventually the alarm would go and the aircraft would be scrambled very quickly and would be dispersed initially. And the dispersal airfield then would take a number of aircraft and we would wait there until we got a release to do our imaginary attack on whatever target had been selected. Once the alert came or was stepped up, the crew put on readiness, and as soon as the alert went off, we'd have to rush out to the aircraft, be it on a bus or running, scramble into the aircraft, do shortened startup checks for the pilots. This meant instead of starting one engine at a time, they'd do what's called a ripple rapid. They'd hit all four buttons and all four engines would start up at the same time, and then we'd get airborne as quickly as we could. Then you'd see three, four aircraft, one after the other, going down the runway very quickly. I mean, for an outsider looking at it, it would be quite a sight to see four Vulcans going off one after the other.
Yeah, I think I've seen some film of one of those scrambles, and it certainly is a very impressive sight.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information. Did you fly other aircraft other than the Vulcan during your career?
I've been fortunate enough while I was in the Air Force to fly in Varsities, Dominies, Jet Promise during training, obviously Hastings and Vulcans. I also got a trip as a passenger in a Lightning, a Buccaneer, Hawk, Tornado, and some transport aircraft and helicopters as well.
Right. What was it like flying in a Lightning?
That was probably the highlight. The aircraft hasn't got a room inside. It's fairly Spartan. And the pilot decided that as soon as we got airborne, that he put reheat on and he just pulled the stick back and we went vertical. And I can always remember looking at the altimeter as it whizzed around. I've never seen anything like it. It's quite amazing, really, how quickly we climbed. I took my hat off to those guys. They had very limited equipment. Their radar was very poor, and yet they carried out air-to-air intercepts. Fantastic job they did, really was. So a great aircraft to fly, and I was very lucky to get that opportunity. It's what I won't forget.
Yeah, I'm hoping to speak to a Lightning pilot in the not-too-distant. I've been in contact with one. What would you say was the most dangerous situation you'd been in during your service in the Royal Air Force?
Well, I was fortunate I never had anything drastically dangerous, but we did have a situation once where I was on 50 Squadron, we got airborne, and the undercarriage had not fully retracted properly. That was the indication that the pilots got. And we were in a situation where we had to make a decision as to whether or not we would attempt to land or we were going to bail out. We had to go over the sea to dump the fuel load because we're on full fuel at that stage. Once that happened, we tried different means to try to get the undercarriage locked down, but we were unsuccessful. And it was then a case as to whether or not the rear crew were going to bail out. We discussed that. And it was decided amongst ourselves that we'd stick with the captain and we'd have a go at landing the aircraft. So it was a bit worrying, to put it mildly, as we came in on the approach. We were fully expecting the undercarriage to collapse and then we'd have the issue of trying to get out the aircraft. So at that point, it was extremely worrying. But fortunately, the undercarriage didn't collapse. And subsequent investigation found out it was something very simple. It was an indication fault in the cockpit. So the undercarriage was fine. But for a period there, it was quite worrying.
I could imagine. Because if the undercarriage had failed, there was no way out for you.
Probably what we would have had to have done is blow the cockpit off and then climb out through the pilot's seats and out that way. And that's probably the only way we could have gone out.
Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. If you'd like to help the project, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.